Hello and welcome to another episode of Jots and Tittles. This is Jeff Riddle, pastor of Christ Reformed Baptist Church in Louisa, Virginia. And in this episode of Jots and Tittles, I'm going to be reading some selections from D.A. Thompson, also known as Bishop D.A. Thompson, on the infamous Canterbury Convocation, out of which came the attempt to not only offer an alternative to the Authorized Version as an English translation, but also an alternative to the underlying Greek text of the New Testament. And I'm going to be reading this excerpt from a new collection of writings that come from D.A. Thompson that has been published by the Bible League Quarterly in the UK. When I was in England in September, I was given a very handsome copy of this book. It's a hardback book. It's titled Valiant for the Truth. It's the collected writings of Bishop D.A. Thompson, former editor of the Bible League Quarterly. And this book was, again, composed of the writings of D.A. Thompson that were selected and edited by John P. Thackway. And Pastor Thackway is the current editor of the Bible League Quarterly. I was really glad to get a copy of this book, and I've enjoyed reading it. I've read probably about two-thirds of it, and I hope that eventually I can write a review of it. And the book is filled with a number of the devotional writings of Bishop Thompson, but also, obviously, with the Bible League Quarterly, it's also has a focus on many of his writings regarding the Bible, both translation of the Bible and the underlying original texts of the Bible. So who was D.A. Thompson, or Bishop D.A. Thompson? He lived from 1896 to 1983. He was a minister in England. In 1916, he was ordained in the Free Church of England. And so there were persons who had withdrawn, I think beginning in the 19th century and on into the 20th century, from the Church of England because of liberalism, things that were perceived to be liberal drifts in the denomination. And so there were people who removed themselves. And so D.A. Thompson would have been someone who was associating with the Free Church of England, so-called. Eventually, from 1938 to 1942, he served as a bishop in the Free Church of England, and therefore he gets the title often as Bishop D.A. Thompson. But after that short stint, he had some dissatisfactions with the Free Church of England himself and withdrew from it. There's a little biographical sketch of Thompson that precedes the book Valiant for Truth that's really interesting reading. Thompson went on in later years to serve as the editor of the Bible League Quarterly from 1961 to 1970, so about 9 years. And again, this book, Valiant for Truth, is a collection of some of the many articles and editorials that he wrote during the time he was the editor of the Bible League Quarterly. One of those articles is titled The Downgrade in Modern English Translations of Scripture, and it's found on pages 154 to 187 in Valiant for Truth. And I thought it would be interesting to read just portions of this because he discusses, again, the infamous Convocation of Canterbury that began in 1870. And ostensibly, this group was given the responsibility of doing a simple or light revision of the Authorized Version. As I said, instead, what they came up with was the English Revised Version with respect to the New Testament that was based on Westcott and Hort's modern critical text. So rather than accomplishing what they might have accomplished, and that was to do what past generations had done, like Blaney's revision of the Authorized Version and maybe updated some of the language and so forth, Instead, they went in such a radical direction that it sort of ruined the opportunity for what might have been a revision of the Authorized Version. Instead, they tried to replace the traditional texts of Scripture, particularly with respect to the New Testament, the underlying Greek text, the Textus Receptus, with the modern critical text. And so it resulted in the English Revised Version sort of being a failure, although we might say they lost the battle in the short term. To some degree, they sort of won the war, at least among many mainline Protestants and evangelicals, by undermining the Textus Receptus. So anyways, I thought that his insights on the Convocation of Canterbury were interesting. He certainly stood in a position where he was closer in time back to those days. I'm guessing that he probably knew persons who were involved in these types of proceedings, particularly in his role, ecclesiastical role as a bishop in the Free Church of England. And so I'm just going to read a bit. I really wasn't aware of this while I was looking at this, that I guess traditionally in the Church of England, there are two convocations. There's one in the northern part of England called the York Convocation, and then one in the southern part of England called the Canterbury Convocation. And he points out that the York Convocation thought that they needed more to give more time and study before doing the revision, but it was the Canterbury Convocation that rushed forward and went ahead with presenting the English Revised Version based on Westcott and Hort's Modern Critical Text. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read just a little bit here from page 174, where he talks about the York Convocation, and then I'm going to read a much longer section from pages 177 to 181, in which he discusses the Canterbury Convocation. And it's especially interesting in that section to hear what he had to say about the role of F.H.A. Scrivener. Sometimes people say, well, Scrivener sort of went along with the revision, but Bishop Thompson indicates that Scrivener was there as more of a conservative, more of a traditionalist, and giving pushback to the whole revision process. So again, let me just pick this up on pages 174 and 175. Thompson writes, "For two or three decades previous to this, some English scholars, mainly liberals but not exclusively so, had advocated that the Authorized Version should be revised. With the appearance of these facsimiles," and he's talking about the printing of Codices Sinaiticus and Vaticanus, "and this New Testament, the few lone voices became a sizable company. Many prominent churchmen, as well as nonconformists, spoke in favor of such a proposal." And then he has a heading, "The York Convocation Viewpoint Shared by Many Others." He writes, "In the Church of England, the Convocation of the Northern Province of York discussed the proposition and, led by its most erudite men, declared that it was too early to embark on such a project. They insisted that ample time must be given for the scholars of Christendom to discuss, debate, and reach a consensus of opinion on the grave problem of the many differences between the Textus Receptus and the vast majority of the manuscripts on the one hand, and these two ancient codices whose readings had only just become available to the learned on the other. Large numbers throughout the English-speaking world strongly supported this judgment." And now I'm going to move on to page 177, where he talks about the decision of the Canterbury Convocation. He says, "But while these scholars, those of the Convocation of York, together with others throughout Christendom, who on reflection found themselves in full agreement with the first named, were given their testimony, another group was coming to the fore and moving in the wrong direction. It is significant that their outreach synchronized with and gave a great impetus to yet another movement which had been turning from biblical truth and was soon to capture many a church and theological chair and become known as modernism or liberalism, the very antithesis of the historic Christian faith. The fact is that the members of the Convocation of Canterbury, meeting shortly after those of their sister province of the North, displayed a very different attitude towards the proposal to revise the authorized version of the Bible. By a majority vote in February 1870, they determined to embark on the undertaking and to set in motion the machinery necessary to that end. Their charge to the revision panels was to abstain from all but necessary changes and to correct none but, quote, plain and clear errors, end quote. From this, it seems, they never contemplated the denigration and abandonment of the traditional Hebrew and Greek texts, but only the rectification of minor blemishes that had long been noted. The Old Testament company honored this ruling, but the New Testament panel soon found themselves under the heavy pressure and influence of two of their number who were extremely averse to being bound by this injunction. These two were Drs. Westcott and Hort, Cambridge dons who had been close friends since undergraduate days. In spirit and in outlook, they were far from being evangelical. They had long been interested in what had become the problem of the New Testament text. They had a great regard for the textual criticism of the German rationalists Griesbach and Lachmann. They were delighted with the appearances of the facsimiles of the Sinaiticus and Vaticanus, and began constructing a new Greek text on the basis of the readings of these codices, much of which was virtually suggested by the notes in the New Testament authorized version issued by Dr. Tischendorf in 1869. Since the readings of these ancient manuscripts differed greatly, they took it upon themselves to decide which of the two texts in any particular place was, quote, intrinsically probable, end quote. These two scholars were supremely eager to seize the opportunity which this revision of the King James Version afforded to foist their own innovated Greek text on the revising panel and so also on the churches. This was to be to the disparagement of the time-honored Textus Receptus, whose readings could be traced back to the end of the 3rd century, if not further back to the very autographs. It is with this New Testament company that we are now concerned. Its membership was very mixed. There were a few conservatives led by Dr. F.H.A. Scribner, who was almost certainly the greatest living authority on the New Testament manuscripts from this time till his death in 1891. Others were broad-minded. They, quote, moved cautiously with the times, end quote. Lastly, there was a Unitarian whose inclusion caused a great deal of controversy. The panel met behind closed doors and under the seal of secrecy. However, certain revelations followed some resignations, and still more was learned of the proceedings when, on the completion of the task in 1881, some of the members wrote on the subject of the changes made in the Greek text and the English translation. It seems that as each reviser took his seat at the table, he produced a sheet which he had been given at the last meeting. This paper had a column of the authorized version printed in the middle, with a wide margin on each side. In the privacy of his home since the last meeting of the panel, he had made notes in these margins. Those on the left had respect to the Greek text, and those on the right concerned the English translation. The session opened with prayer. This was followed by the reading of the minutes of the last deliberations. Then it would appear that Dr., later to become Professor Hort, distributed to each one present the proof sheet of the text of the Greek, of the New Greek New Testament, of the passage of Scripture to be considered, which he and Professor Westcott, for so he had just become, had constructed. It had been agreed that Bishop Samuel Wilberforce should be the chairman of this company, but at the very commencement of its proceedings, he was outvoted in objecting to the inclusion of a Unitarian among the revisers. And so from that day to his death, July 18, 1873, he absented himself from the sessions. His place was taken by Dr. C.J. Ellicott, Bishop of the then United Diocese of Gloucester and Bristol, who only missed two out of 407 sittings. As chairman, Dr. Ellicott would first call on Dr. Scribner to read the Textus Receptus and to defend its readings against those given in the proof text of the presumed corrected text. Dr. Hort would follow and do his best to persuade, if not to insist, on his fellow revisers abandoning the traditional text and adopting his and Professor Westcott's new readings. Thus, the sessions often became a debate, if not a duel, between Dr. Scribner setting forth the centuries-old traditional text and Dr. Hort and his professor arguing for their innovations. This embarrassed most of the company. They were at home in Greek, but out of their depths in textual criticism. Within a short time, several resigned, whilst others showed their dissatisfaction by their rare attendance. Most of the members usually deferred to the Cambridge Dons, but only because of their university standing. When these two got their way, the English text was altered accordingly. When their suggestions were too radical for the majority, through the support of the Broad School, they often secured the insertion of a footnote embodying their contention. Hence the remark soon gained currency that, quote, the poison was chiefly in the notes, end quote. Many editions of the revised version were issued without footnotes. At length, the work was finished, but Professors Westcott and Hort were determined to be the first in the field. On May 12th of 1881, their new, many felt and some still feel inaccurate and corrupt, Greek text of the New Testament was published. It was thus launched with not all, but much of the prestige of the revision company behind it. Yet it must be stressed that this new text represented little more than the judgments and prejudices of these Cambridge Dons, built on the foundation of a few others who had labored before them. It certainly lacked the wholehearted endorsement of the other revisers. Those present and voting often rejected the proposals of these two professors, or else their readings were relegated to the footnotes. On May 17, 1881, the English Revised Version New Testament was issued. It is only right to acknowledge that there are a few improvements, but that they are far outweighed by serious blemishes. Both the Westcott and Hort Greek text and this new English revision met with a hostile reception, and not without good reason. The next year, the Cambridge University Press published the Parallel New Testament. The authorized version of 1611 is printed in a parallel column with the revised version of 1881, together with the Greek of the text followed by the scholars of 1611 and the variations adopted in 1881. It thus shows at a glance the changes made in both the Greek and English. It was edited by Dr. Scribner. The Oxford University Press followed with a similar volume edited by Archdeacon Palmer. Reflections. Here's the last section we'll read under the heading Reflections from page 180. The general course of the proceedings of 1870 to 1881 is deeply to be regretted. First, the inclusion of a Unitarian on the translation panel was, in the judgment of the truly Orthodox, a great mistake. It is an undeniable fact that some of the renderings give distinct pleasure to those who deny the essential deity of Christ. For example, Romans 9:5 margin and 1 Timothy 3:16. Other revisions and translations which have followed have gone still further in weakening the testimony of the text to the Godhead of Jesus. Further, the differences in the Greek between that of the Textus Receptus on the one part and those of the Vaticanus and Sinaiticus and other manuscripts on the other should have been considered, debated, and criticized for perhaps a decade or more by the scholars of Christendom, perhaps in installments through the pages of theological journals. Not until some consensus of opinion had been reached by the great majority should any suggestion have been put forward to amend the traditional text, and not until the representatives of the major Protestant churches and minor and other groups too, if possible, had considered these suggestions and approved should the Textus Receptus have undergone any alteration. In the judgment of many scholarly believers, Professors Westcott and Hort displayed unseemly haste in pressing their revolutionary texts on the reviewers without giving Christian scholars of other lands, no whit less concerned with the problem of the Greek text in the autograph, an opportunity to express their judgments. Moreover, it seemed bordering on unscrupulousness to send forth their newly constructed text to the world, one which had not the unanimous approval of their colleagues, just a few days before the issue of the Revised Version. The whole business had something of the marks of a fait accompli about it. Again, the issue of a new Greek text and the English revision set precedence. Many liberals rejoiced at the grievous blow given to the reputation of the Textus Receptus, but they were not wholly satisfied with the Westcott and Hort text, so that there have been what are in effect several revisions of it, and still there is no entire agreement as to how the Greek should read. Similarly, the English 1881 and the American 1901 revisions have been followed by 30 or 40 more translations. This has led to confusion in more ways than one. The several Greek and the many English revisions have undermined the belief of many in what had previously been regarded as a fundamental doctrine of the faith, the verbal inspiration of Scripture. The cry, "Back to the Bible," should involve "Back to the Textus Receptus" and "Back to the Authorized Version," whose only drawback is the presence of some words which have become obsolete or have changed in meaning, and which could be rectified by a marginal note. And I'll end here this selected reading from this article, "The Downgrade in Modern English Translations of Scripture," that appears in the collection of the writings of Bishop D.A. Thompson, titled "Valiant for the Truth." Again, we'll bring this, not only this reading, but also this episode of Jots and Tittles to a conclusion. Hope you've enjoyed this and will be edified by it as we reflect on Bishop Thompson's evaluations, I guess, around the middle to late 20th century of the decisions that came about in the Convocation of Canterbury in the late 19th century. We'll look forward to speaking to you in the next edition of Jots and Tittles. Till then, take care and God bless.